Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's once again a pleasure to be here. I was in the reference to my television career, I was reminded that I'm also the host of Running, and recently I was interviewed on television, and basically the question was, how can you stand it? Hours and hours and hours of politicians, and I said, I tried to explain to them, there is a professional role I'm asked to play, so that's what I do when I'm on television with political candidates. In any case, this is about Everett Hepp, who was, I got interested in him because of my dad had talked about him and somehow knew him. I don't think he knew him from court. My father wasn't a lawyer, but my dad had a high opinion of him, and I thought that was interesting given the number of people my dad had feuded with over the years. So I was struck by this, and it stayed with me. Everett Hepp was a significant figure in Fairbanks for most of 30 years, playing a classic sequence of roles. The young assistant district attorney in Fairbanks in the 40s, the district attorney in Fairbanks who preceded Ted Stevens as district attorney in Fairbanks, a private practitioner, once again in Fairbanks, usually in the criminal defense, and Superior Court judge. Hepp never entered politics, unlike Ted Stevens or Mike Stepovich, also who were his peers as lawyers in Fairbanks, and unlike many other Fairbanks lawyers over the years who have entered politics. I'm sure there are lawyers in this room who knew Hepp and can tell you about his views of politics. I'm almost certain he was a registered Democrat because he was appointed U.S. Attorney for Fairbanks by the Truman administration. And when Eisenhower became president in the early 50s, he was asked to resign and did. It was replaced by Ted Stevens. Maybe Everett Hepp wasn't interested in politics. Maybe he lacked the ambition. Maybe he understood the limited powers of the Alaska Territorial Legislature and the difficulty, as many lawyers have found, of maintaining a legal practice while you're trying to be a member of the Alaska Legislature. And of course, there's a possibility maybe he just wanted to practice law. There are such people who don't have political ambition. Or maybe he wanted to become a judge. In any case, Everett Warne, W-A-R-N-E, Hepp, was born August 26, 1915, in Milwaukee, Oregon, a suburb of Portland, and grew up in several other Oregon cities. In the 1930 census, his father, Lewis, and I have the 30 census page for you here, was a high school teacher in Grants Pass, Oregon. The census gives Lewis's salary at $5,000 a year, which would have been good money, especially during the Depression. The Hepp seemed to have moved more than once. Hepp's birth year, 1915, means he was old enough to remember both the end of the Roaring Twenties and the onset of the Great Depression. Like my father, he came of age during the Depression. Lewis Hepp, his father was a teacher, a high school teacher it seems, would have stressed education, and Everett Hepp seems to have had a good education, having gone to the Berkeley Law School and graduated in 1940. In 1940, he married Elizabeth Pickering in the spring, but the marriage didn't last, and they may not have been together very long. They divorced in Nevada in 1946, and somebody asked, well, how would you know that? And the answer is surprising that I went on to newspapers on Ancestry.com, which is one of the many excellent search engines on the web. It's a paid subscription service, and they had, I put in Everett Hepp's name, and what do you know, up it came in a number of places, especially in Alaska, but also in Nevada, and that was just a classified announcement of his divorce. In his application many years later, to the Pioneers of Alaska, Hepp said that he worked in Oakland for 14 months to pay school bills and save enough money to head north. That means Fairbanks, or means Alaska. Clearly, he was determined to come to Alaska at a very early age, or at least as a young man. He adds, I hitchhiked, rode freight trains, and ultimately I was in steerage to Ketchikan and thence to Sitka, where I lived for 3 months. He went on to Fairbanks. He describes himself, and you'll see this in the documents, at 5'9" and gives his weight. He first came to Fairbanks in August of 1942. He According to his application to the Pioneers of Alaska, and I only gave you part of it because it would have gone on for a few pages, he did some dog mushing. He was he made a trip on the Yukon River. The trip on the Yukon River, this would be in the summertime by boat, was with the photographer Steve McCutcheon of the well-known McCutcheon family here in Anchorage. And I had hoped that there would be photographs of that trip that Steve McCutcheon would have taken, but there don't appear to have to be any. It's not clear why he was not drafted quickly, but then again, there were a lot of people who were not drafted until later during the war, including my dad, who was drafted in 1945. In Hep's case, he was drafted in 1944. Perhaps he was doing important civilian work. That seems to have been something that was very common here in Alaska, that people who were had a civilian labor, especially for the military, were kept in their jobs. He was released from the Army in 1946, and there's a nice story right here on this second page that I have for you. After release, he and his second wife, Dorothy Polachuk, sailed from Honolulu to San Francisco in a 28-foot yawl. The trip took 42 days and drew national attention. This particular story and this photograph are repeated again and again and again in many parts of the country through the AP wire service. And if you look carefully at the top of the page, it might surprise you to note that this is from the newspaper in Syracuse, New York. To give you a better picture of him as an adult, I've included this photograph of the first court system in the state of Alaska, which is the next page. Hep was determined to return to Alaska and did, to Fairbanks. In 1948, he passed the Alaska bar and became assistant U.S. attorney. In 1949, he was nominated to become the U.S. attorney, and he served as the United States attorney until 1953, when, as I mentioned earlier, he was replaced by Ted Stevens. From 53 to 59, he was in private practice. After statehood, Governor Bill Egan, made him a Superior Court judge. I'm going to tell you about some of his cases as a prosecutor, as a defense attorney, and as a judge that I think will illustrate his career. These are mostly earlier cases rather than from the 60s or 70s, although there are a couple later cases because I thought that those who knew him and could talk about him might want to know more about his earlier career. The first case, this was when he was an assistant prosecutor, must have been very early in his career, was the case of Joe Cox and Robert Kelly, who were tried for murder, manslaughter in Fairbanks in 1948 in the death of a man named Pierce Hicks. This was an unusual case because it involved a man named Raymond Wright, who ran clubs in Fairbanks and comes up repeatedly in Everett Hep's life, as we shall see. Joe Kelly Robert Kelly and his partner, Joe Cox, went to a bar in South Fairbanks after they'd been out on a hunting trip and got into a beef with the owner, Raymond Wright. There seems to be something personal about Wright. Had some kind of involvement with Kelly's sister. Wright threw them out of the place, perhaps violently, and said that, and the two men, Kelly and his partner, said they would be back. And somebody came back in a pickup truck that may or may not have been their pickup truck and started shooting at the building and killed one of the patrons of this bar, a man named Pierce Hicks. There was a long trial that was covered in the Newsminer at the time that resulted in a hung jury. There was no verdict. And while the territory of Alaska was deciding whether to retry this case, Mr. Kelly drowned. And that's this note here from Warren Taylor, who is his defense attorney, that I've handed out to you. Somewhat later, and this is in 1955, and now I'm going to give you an example of let's back up here for one more case that when one of the big cases, one of his first cases, when Hep went into private practice. This is the Cecil Wells murder. Hep would have stepped down as U.S. Attorney in Fairbanks in August of 1953. Cecil Wells, who was a very prominent businessman, and I've talked about this here before and many people know about this, was murdered in his apartment at the Northward Building while his wife was present in the room. In October of 1953, this was probably as sensational a murder as Alaska has ever known, at least before there was television and court TV. Diane Wells was the beautiful, proverbial beautiful blonde, and she really was. There are many photographs of her. She had a jazz musician boyfriend who is constantly referred to as in the news reporting of the time as the Negro musician, Johnny Warren, and they were put on trial. The wife and her boyfriend, her lover, were about to be put on trial. They were indicted. Excuse me. We need to back up here for the murder of Cecil Wells, and were about to be tried with Everett Hep acting as musician Johnny Warren's defense attorney. When in the spring of 1953, to the shock of Ted Stevens, who'd walked into Fairbanks and found himself in the middle of this very, very big and widely discussed case, not just here, but I found English newspaper clippings that referred to this, the Wells murder. the beautiful Diane Wells took her life, committed suicide in a Hollywood hotel room, and the state or the territory of Alaska did not proceed with the case again, or the federal government. I got to get the details right here. It's a federal case because we were a territory at that time. Never proceeded with the trial of Johnny Warren. It's very interesting of the expression of the times that Johnny Warren's indictment remained open for another 6 years before it was dismissed after statehood. But this was a very big case, and Hep would have had a role in it in preparing Warren's defense, and Warren never came to trial after Diane committed suicide. As a defense attorney, Hep was also involved with Willamae and Harding Perry. And these people interest me because they were bar owners in South Fairbanks, they were gamblers, they were night people, as my dad would call them. Actually, my dad would call them the parasites, but that's obviously a prejudicial term. Who owned a club in South Fairbanks, and owned several clubs in South Fairbanks. And I tried to talk to Ted Stevens about the Perrys, and he'd been, as a prosecutor, tried to prosecute them many times on many different charges. Arson was one of them. Concealing stolen property was another one. Running bars where GIs would be taken for their paychecks with drugs and their alcohol and so forth. And so I'd mentioned to Ted, well, what about the Perrys? And he'd go, "Wah! The Perrys!" And this was a great frustration to him that he was never able to put the Perrys in jail. I mean, we're talking about 40 years later, right? So you can see here in these two, in a clip I have from the newspaper, case ends after witness claims threat by police, and then you have Mr. John Peters' confession or statement he gave to the police during the investigation. This was a case in which the Perrys allegedly burned down their club/home in South Fairbanks to collect the insurance money, which was something like $7,000. And Harding and Willamae had John Peters participate in this, and Peters explains his role in this in the statement he gave to prosecutors here in Anchorage that's in your material. This trial, and this was, of course, the kind of thing that clearly aggravated Ted Stevens no end. When they got to trial and they put Mr. Peters up on the witness stand and asked him about his statement that he gave to the police and investigators in Anchorage, he was asked, first of all, if he gave this statement of his own volition. Mr. Peters said, "My own what?" So they had to explain that to them, and they asked him if he gave this free and clear, and it was his own testimony, and it was not forced, and he said, "Oh, yeah, that's all true, except for that police officer who threatened to break my head." So he insisted, and then the judge, who was Vernon Forbes at that time, had the jury taken out of the room, and they had a big conference about this, and Mr. Peters resumed his testimony and insisted all along that he only said, he may not have known what coercion was or volition was, but he insisted he knew what it was when a police officer threatened to break his head, and he said, "I've had my head broken before. I didn't want to get it broken again." I'm very skeptical about the facts of this, but eventually the case against the Harding and Willa Mae Perry collapsed. The charges were dismissed, and Mr. Peters was tried for perjury. The poor man, I guess. Then there's also the case, the Baroka prostitution case, which this is one of those colorful stories that the Newsminer couldn't resist in the 1950s, and they put it on the first page, on the front page. Lady of the Night found not guilty. This is a story about, and this would have been something. How commonly known was what went on in South Fairbanks and other parts of town? I think it was very well known throughout the community, of a working girl, a prostitute, who had a customer who was a serviceman, and after he'd enjoyed her favors, he refused to pay her. At some point, she asked him for the military discount, and he still refused to pay. So she hit him over the head with a whiskey bottle. And the police were called, and there was blood and so forth. And Everett Hepp is defending Miss Baroka, the lady of the evening, who the Newsminer didn't worry too much about characterization. They called her Miss Baroka, a rotund armful of a woman. In any case, the jury heard this case and pretty quickly returned a not guilty verdict against Miss Baroka for hitting the soldier over the head. And we don't get to interview the jurors at this point. And this is an interesting aside, a detail. In the Fairbanks newspapers in the 50s, and I don't know when it stopped, probably sometime in the 60s, they put the names of all the jurors right there. They would put who the prosecutor was, who the defense attorneys were, and they would put in the name of the judge, and then they'd put in the jurors. But I think that, first of all, the jurors may have felt that this airman, serviceman, had it coming to him. He asked for it if he wasn't willing to pay after having enjoyed her company. And second, I think there was a real feeling in Fairbanks of, at that time, that women, especially women who didn't have much education or much opportunity, had to do what they had to do to survive, and there wasn't a particular instinctive prejudice against people, against women in particular, who were forced to do these kind of things. Now, in 1957, Everett Hepp, again in his role as defense attorney, was involved in the Whitey Matinon murder trial. He was a defense attorney with a man named E.P. McCarron. And E.P. McCarron, Earl McCarron, interested me because he showed up for a period of time in the 50s and early 60s as a prominent lawyer in Fairbanks. I wondered what happened to him. And because this was a guy who was in a lot of high-profile cases, and you thought to yourself, would show up in the news, and all of a sudden he stops. So why was that? Well, it turned out that his wife became ill, and they'd gone to Florida, and then they both died very quickly at a relatively young age. The Matinon murder case was made quite a bit of by the Newsminer. This is another case that I had some peripheral awareness of because my dad knew Whitey Matinon, who was the defendant in this case. This was a classic case on the face of it, or simple enough case on the face of it, of a triangle between a husband, a wife, and the boyfriend, who is constantly referred to as handsome or curly-haired in the much younger boyfriend in the text of the newspaper. And Whitey Matinon, his wife, Vivian, or Vi, as she was known to people, left him, went to live with this other fellow, took up with him, and not only that, married him without getting divorced from Whitey Matinon. She actually eventually had to go to trial for that. And Whitey Matinon came over there and shot him. So the question was he suffering some kind of mental disability or debility of physical and mental disability when he committed this crime, and should he received some consideration for it, for the mental state that he was in of having lost his wife. And I just thought I'd read a little bit from this newspaper here, because it was only when I was reading this, I don't know if sometimes things occur to you when you read something for the fifth or sixth time, that this is this newspaper account that has the word weather on it. This is where newspaper reporting really verges on literature or attempts to become literature, as you can see very quickly in just the first couple of paragraphs. There was a curious stillness, an anxious hush in the courtroom as the woman testified. This was the woman whose husband was on trial for slaying her lover. This was Vivian Matinen, a plump, pleasant-looking cook of 34, dressed neatly and plainly. She had volunteered to testify, and she told a story in open court that many women would not admit even to themselves. This is why I say this is the writer here is engaging in literature, which is fine, but it's quite noticeable, I would say. Eventually, there was this trial went on most of a week. There was extensive testimony from Vivian, the ex-wife. And one of the things that the defense attorney, Hep and E.P. McCarron, got her to discuss was that this would be to presumably reflect on the character of the deceased handsome boyfriend, that he had suggested to her that if she took up with him, which she eventually did, married him, she could go into prostitution and they'd be on Easy Street. Apparently, this is a story that men tell women from different times, and it works. I do not understand this, but it does. In any case, Matinen was cleared, and the newspaper made it a point to remind the readers that this is a time that the death penalty was still something that was available to prosecutors and judges here in Alaska. And that Matinen had, in theory, faced the death penalty. I think by now there have been several years before there had been an execution here in Alaska, so that probably was unlikely. But you can see, again, the newspaper reporter's affection for the melodramatic and the literary when he announces the verdict. Whitey Matinen, cleared of a first-degree murder charge yesterday, cried quickly as he shook hands with jurors, then went to the Steele Hotel last night to pray to the man up there. He told attorneys he wanted to spend some time alone after spending 7 months in the shadows of the hangman's noose, and so forth. Matinen now faces a sanity hearing before Judge Vernon Forbes. If Matinen is dangerous to the time, he will be sent away and so forth. If the judge rules he's sane, Matinen can resume his outdoor life he lived and loved. Well, this is very interesting and very unusual and very surprising, at least from a 21st century perspective. He was found temporarily insane and they were going to send him to a facility that handled people who were temporarily insane and been involved in criminal activities. Morningside, the traditional mental hospital for Alaska's insane in Oregon, did not want to take him, and they could not, and said that they did not take this kind of patient, and they could not find a facility in the United States. This is in a week of searching, and makes you wonder how hard they searched, that would take him. So then you have this page over here, in which it says, this is the judge's order, Vernon D. Forbes. On the 14th of March, 1957, came the United States Marshal A.F. Dorsch, represented by George M. Yeager, United States Attorney, and defendant appeared in person and by counsel of E.P. McCarron. That's Earl McCarron, who was in this with Everett Hep. It appearing to this court that the United States does not have a lunatic asylum, now there's an old-fashioned term, authorized to receive and keep the defendant, Harold George Matinen, and that the section 6338-1378 of the Alaska Compiled Laws annotated under which he was committed is an operative. Therefore, it is ordered that Harold George Martin Matinen is hereby discharged from custody. A very unusual ending to this particular case. Everett Hep also was the defense attorney, co-counsel in the Culp murder case, and this was a very unusual, in some ways, after I read the outcome of the case, I was a little surprised maybe that it was brought, in which a man, a native Alaskan, and his wife were driving in their pickup truck. It may have been a panel truck, I'm trying to remember here, but in any case, she fell out and died. And so the prosecutors brought a charge murder charge against Mr. Culp, and he was tried. And the question was, had he pushed her, or did she fall out the door by accident? And eventually, the case was resolved in favor of the defendant. It may have been that in some ways the jury had a hard time believing that somebody would actually go to that length of killing his wife in that fashion. You can see that it made the front page of the Daily Newsminer, and this Newsminer is a very interesting example of the paper, the Fairbanks Daily Newsminer in the 50s was a very lively paper with a lot of news in it. In some ways, I think it may have been better than it was later. This was during the middle of the North American. There's a picture of Alfred Wells, who had won that particular heat, was a famed musher at that time. Finally, I have two other cases I want to talk to you about. One is in 1961. The other is in 1964. It should be 1971. But I'm going to go ahead and tell you about that, and then skip back to the 1964 case because the 71 case is shorter and the 64 case is longer. 1971 case, and this is to me is very unusual, is an abortion case in which a doctor named Dr. Boswell was charged with committing an abortion. And I had never seen this, Carl Boswell, I'd never seen an abortion case in all these records that I've gone through in territorial and state Alaska. I'm sure there must have been one, but this is the first example that I'd seen of an abortion trial. Well, first thing I was curious about was what was the state of the law at that time. So again, this is the 70s. And we know that later the Alaska legislature made abortion legal in good measure because of the efforts of John Rader in his role as a legislator and some of his allies. But in this particular case, the law at the time provided that abortion was illegal except if necessary to save the life of the mother. And it seems that that's what this case ultimately came down to and why Dr. Boswell was not convicted. Up in the microfilm of Fairbanks somewhere, there is a detailed account of this, or there's the trial record of this case. Dr. Boswell was not in Alaska for a particularly long time. This may have had something to do with why he left. There's an interesting footnote to this case. Bill Taylor, William Taylor, who some of you also would know, was the judge in Fairbanks who tried this case. Dr. Boswell could not get representation in Fairbanks. Now, I don't know if this was because of the nature of the case, there were lawyers who just say, I don't refuse to participate in a case like this. He went to them and was turned down. It seems to stretch credibility that all the lawyers in town who handled criminal defense were busy. So Bill Taylor came up with a solution of who should be the court-appointed attorney to defend Dr. Boswell. The answer was Dad. He appointed Warren Taylor, his father. So Warren Taylor was the defense attorney in this case, and he was a veteran by this time, very much a veteran of the criminal defense bar, and he clearly represented Dr. Boswell very vigorously. Now, finally, I wanted to talk about here one more of the major cases that Everett Hepp was involved in, and that is the Drew Pearson libel case. And this is, as John McKay, my dear friend and guest in the room, a member of the audience, can tell you, is a really important case, not just in Alaska, but in the history of libel. And I also should note for you that I had some handouts, I don't know if there are any of them left, that are essentially what the Supreme Court said in upholding Judge Hepp's decision in this case, and the actual alleged libelous material. This case started in the heated summer of 1958 when Drew Pearson, who was a very well-known and very famous and very influential and very litigious himself, he'd sued any number of people, columnist whose column was printed all over the United States, wrote a column in which he commented on Alaska statehood and said the real father of Alaska statehood is Senator Ernest Greening. What he left out was, you know, one of my best friends. But he said the real hero of Alaska statehood was Ernest Greening, and that Mike Stepovich, the governor of Alaska and Fairbanks' favorite son at this time, was merely a Johnny-come-lately. This is right there in the column and very prominent in the column. This so inflamed Bill Snedden, the publisher of the Fairbanks News Miner, that he wrote an editorial in which he quoted somebody in Washington, D.C. who had called Drew Pearson the garbage man of the Fourth Estate. And then he said that he went on to say that there's some pretty good stuff in here. You can go through these clippings and see some of the details of what was alleged. And Wayne Morse came up here to testify on behalf of Pearson. But the offensive column was the offensive note in Pearson to Snedden was the beginning. A lot of Johnny-come-latelys, such as Governor Mike Stepovich, are now claiming credit for making Alaska the 49th state. None of this is true. It's Ernest Greening. What you really have to know and wouldn't know just from looking at the legal record of this is the context. Mike Stepovich was running against Ernest Greening for the United States Senate in the summer of 1958. Mike Stepovich was the governor of Alaska, and he was a territorial governor and was not going to continue when statehood came, and so he was running for the Senate against Greening. So this was a super heated and political environment in which Drew Pearson had issued his Johnny-come-lately remarks about Stepovich. There's also an element of this which I know from looking at Bill Snedden's correspondence with Fred Seaton, who was the Secretary of the Interior, and most of this correspondence is in the Eisenhower Library in Abilene, Kansas, is, not to put too fine a point on it, Bill Snedden couldn't stand Ernest Greening. Ernest Greening, and in fact, actually, there's a very telling and amusing point in here. It talks about this is in rebuttal when Snedden had written an editorial chastising Pearson and talking about him being the garbage man of the Third Estate. Pearson had said that Greening had worked unobtrusively for statehood. And this is what Snedden has to say. One word in Mr. Pearson's column about Ernest Greening sticks out like a sore thumb. The word says he worked unobtrusively in Washington. It sticks out because it is so devastatingly inappropriate. If you've ever seen anyone being unobtrusive, you won't have to ask if his name is Ernest Greening. What's telling about what really is at the heart of this, I think, is in some ways it was kind of too bad for Alaska. Not only were Snedden and Ernest Greening of different political parties, but they both had very high opinions of themselves, and I suspect that they were in conflict almost from the first time they met, which was when Ernest Greening visited the News Miners in Fairbanks. In any case, let's go to the trial. The trial was in Fairbanks, and there were a variety of people who testified to what Snedden had said about Pearson. There were people who testified as to Pearson's reputation. There were people who, and it was interesting because the lawyering, they both had Fairbanks lawyers. Snedden had Henry Camero and Bob McNeely. Although Camero, somebody may remember, was he in Anchorage? He was later in Anchorage, I think. I don't remember. Does anybody remember him or know him? In any case, Snedden had his own local attorneys, Pearson had his own local attorneys, and some of you may remember Millard Ingram. I recently exchanged some emails from him, and he was a very young attorney. This is one of the first things he worked on at Fairbanks was this case, which The alleged libel took place in 1958. The trial was in 1964, and the Supreme Court did not issue a final decision until 1966. Now, this is the case is formerly known as Drew Pearson versus Fairbanks Publishing, and the Supreme Court of Alaska, Judge Diamond and Moody and Davis delivered their rendering on the appeal in 1966, and I've left a few of them out. It's a very interesting document because, first of all, they made it clear they didn't believe that the term garbage man of the Fourth Estate was correct, that it was factually wrong. But there was a question here about, and this is after the Sullivan libel case in the U.S. Supreme Court, of was the speech privileged anyway because primarily because it was done without malice? And they have some discussion of what malice is, which might interest you. It did me. This is actual malice must be defined. And then he goes on to say, actual malice is ill will, enmity, hatred, spite, or a desire to injure the plaintiff in her fame, reputation, or profession, or to degrade, ridicule, or disgrace her. This is quoting from an earlier case, hence the gender. That covers a lot of ground for insulting somebody. That's certainly for sure. But the court said, and this I think especially is interesting in a new young state, that this was an era when we should have very vigorous debate and open and intense debate here in Alaska over political issues, that this was really important and we would accept very robust discussion. Also, Judge Hepp, I thought this was kind of interesting in the trial record. In the newspaper accounts of the trial record, sort of gave away his feelings about this when he suggested, it wasn't this clear, but the message was this clear. What he said wasn't this clear, but his message was this clear. Listen, we got two newspaper men here in a courtroom trying to settle this with the law. That isn't the way newspaper men settle their disputes. Why don't you go back and be newspaper men? You got something to say about one another? Go ahead and say it. But he was asked to handle this case and to be the judge in this case, and he did, and eventually the court upheld him. It's also kind of interesting in the question of newspapering, I think, that not only, I mentioned earlier, it really is true. When you go back and look at Drew Pearson's record, for all of his prestige and success, he sued any number of people. It, to me, is very odd for a newspaperman. Maybe he, our goal usually is to stay out of court if ever we can. And Howard Weaver used to say, if you want to stay out of libel cases, the best way to do it is don't libel somebody. But Pearson took, he was a person who gave offense, but apparently he didn't take it as well as he gave it. So he was in a number of cases. The other thing is, I did talk to you about the political context, the 1958 election, in which I should note Greening beat Stepovich very easily, and this led to another aspect of the relationship between Stepovich and Bill Snedden, the newsminer. It's pretty clear from reading the record that not only did Bill Snedden have a very low opinion of Ernest Greening and his what he thought was his gigantic ego, it really infuriated him that Mike Stepovich couldn't beat Ernest Greening. So he was very reluctant to support him, or he was reluctant, I shouldn't say very reluctant, he was reluctant to support him in his Stepovich and his future political endeavors. There's an interesting thing there's an interesting detail here that of newspapering, and that is when Snedden wrote his first editorial calling Pearson the garbage man of the Fourth Estate, He at the end of it, he said, we haven't made up our mind, collectively, the editorial us, whether we're going to cancel Pearson's column or not. For the moment, we'll just put a nose pin, we'll put a pin over our nose from the wash line, and we'll make up our mind somewhere down the road about what we're going to do about him. It just seemed to me that if you were that mad, you'd maybe want to just get rid of him, but that isn't what he did. And it took some time, a few weeks, before they finally said that they weren't going to accept Pearson because they questioned his factuality. From the point of view of Snedden, Pearson was entitled to his, this has been said many, many, many times, he was entitled to his point of view, but he wasn't entitled to his facts, so they canceled his column and got somebody else. But once again, the context of this is all in the 1958 U.S. Senate election, in which people had very, very strong opinions about that election. Finally, I mentioned earlier the story about Raymond Wright and the nightclub in which a man named Pierce Hicks was shot and died in 1948, and the shots came from outside the building, and there was a trial, and Mr. Kelly drowned, and so forth. Raymond Wright continually shows up in the life of Everett Hepp. And it's a very, to me, interesting piece of small town or medium-sized town law. His relationship with Ray Wright, Hepp's relationship, included this. In 1948, Wright was a witness in the Cox-Kelly murder in which Hepp was the assistant prosecutor. In 1951, Hepp prosecuted Wright for procuring a woman for purposes of prostitution. Wright was convicted under the prosecution of Hepp and sent to a federal prison for 3 years. Back in town, Hepp's now in the, Wright's still in the sector that he's in, and Hepp is now in private practice. Hepp defended Wright in a check forgery scandal that involved both Anchorage and Fairbanks, and this was a very big high profile case, which Hepp won on behalf of Wright, who he'd put into prison earlier, on appeal. In 1961, Hepp, still as judge, issued a variety of warrants for Wright for stealing drugs. In 1963, after Raymond Wright was murdered in Fairbanks in another sensational criminal murder, Wright was the trial judge presiding over the case of the man who was charged with murdering Wright. So this is quite a bit of activity for a relationship for one member of the community. And it's interesting because after Wright died, and this is how much trouble one person can get into, this is the court now under J. Rabinowitz, dismisses charges against Wright. At this point, the charges that were missed included blackmail, larceny, uttering a forged instrument, and perjury. That was the end of the career of Raymond Wright, and I'm told the number of people who, I don't remember this, I would have been a high school kid, who told me in the grand tradition of Chicago, Ray Wright's funeral was one of the biggest in Fairbanks, and after he had been shot, and the man who shot him, or allegedly shot him, a cab driver named Tarot, as in tarot cards, was tried in Hepp's courtroom and not convicted. And to my knowledge, nobody ever was convicted of that particular shooting. This is a look at the career of Everett Hepp, one man who came to Alaska and left his mark and participated in the law and was a member of the legal community at a time of great, when the modern legal system of Alaska was being formed, and when some people in this room and some of our friends who are not here today were young people learning the law and getting an opportunity to practice law. And I know I've had emails from several people who knew Everett Hepp, and they may not have always agreed with him, but they did appreciate him. I was running short of time, so I was going to leave this out, but we have 2 or 3 minutes, so I'm going to talk about one other thing, and that is the judicial retention matters involving Everett Hepp. And this is in your material here. He stood for retention several times as judge, and he was retained both times. And I found it, and you'll see in here, the Bar Association and others put up advertising saying no on Everett Hepp. And then there's a letter, his own letter to the voters, says talking about why he should be retained. And then there's some more material here on Hepp's on hips, retention fights. These, I was really surprised by this, that there was, and I talked to Millard Ingram, who was the president of the bar at that time, and apparently it was a very close vote on whether he should be retained. And he, in public, Millard would talk about how there were very different reasons. People had different ideas about why he, why they thought he shouldn't be retained. But there also appears to have been some feeling, especially among lawyers who were involved in damage suits and suits against insurance companies and doctors, that Hepp as a judge was too favorable to those kind of defendants. I have no idea of the truth of this. There may be something else involved, but he weathered the storm in several of these retention battles. Finally, as I note here, that Everett Hepp was involved in another major incident in Fairbanks, or there's another major story that doesn't have to do with him practicing the law. In 1960, he was on a fishing trip with a prominent businessman named George Nerbus, and they got somewhere down near Healy, or they probably would have been more out in the flats, but it would have been west of Nenana, perhaps towards Manly Hot Springs, and they damaged the aircraft. This looks like a 206 they had, something like that, and had to repair it themselves. And when they were flying back to Fairbanks, the plane essentially wouldn't fly anymore and came to pieces, and they wound up crashing into the Tanana River right there at Nenana, and Hepp was rescued, and George Nerbus, N-E-H-R-B-A-S, was not. This was a major story, not just for the newspapers of Fairbanks, but the whole Fairbanks community. Nerbus had been a very successful businessman. He was very active in the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, and it was viewed as quite a tragedy when he died. I found it, what can I say, unsettling, I guess it would be the word, that I did find a Nerbus family website. George Nerbus did not have children, but there are other members of his family who specifically blamed Hepp for the death of Nerbus. I'm sure there would have been it would have been the FAA or CAA at that time, investigation of some kind, or National Transportation Safety Board. I have not seen it, but this was, and Everett Hepp himself was severely damaged. He had head injuries. This must have been quite a traumatic experience for him, and it was a traumatic experience for the community. If you're familiar with Fairbanks, you know the little Chamber of Commerce building on First Avenue by the Cushman Street Bridge. Many people in the Fairbanks community, including Bill Snedden, suggested that Nerbus, more than anybody else, was responsible for raising the money and providing the material for that particular building. Everett Hepp retired from the law in Fairbanks in 1975 and moved to Washington State, where he died in 1987. He would have been 70-something years old, depending, 75 or 74. As I said, this is my attempt to provide you with some insight into a man who was a vigorous member of the community and a vigorous member of the legal profession for a period of close to 30 years in Fairbanks and in Alaska. Thank you. I know everybody's got to go back to work or they have other activities. If anybody wants to talk to me afterwards, I'd be glad to stay here and take your questions or comments.